You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Spring Forward by Vanessa Grigoriadis, with photos by Gillian Loeb. The 80,000 American girls who pursue competitive gymnastics in their hometowns each year are not necessarily going to come into contact with predators. This is a sport that requires adults to stretch, touch, spot, and establish trust with children, and most of those adults do so without malicious intent. The problem that arose in the highest ranks of USAG among the 20 American girls who compete for the Olympic team stemmed from a confluence of factors, only some of which are relevant to lower-ranked gymnasts throughout the country. To understand why Nassar's predation was so thoroughgoing, you have to understand the evolution of contemporary gymnastics. Until 1972, when 85-pound 17-year-old Olga Korbut won Olympic gold, top female gymnasts were in their 20s. Male gymnasts, too, were in their 20s at the time and remain so today. 4 years later, 14-year-old Nadia Comaneci earned the sport's first perfect 10. After she added a double twisting backflip off the beam to Corbett's simpler routine, the reign of slender teenage pixies continued until 2006, when the International Gymnastics Federation shifted its scoring system to encourage more complex routines. This worked perhaps better than it imagined. The shift to an athletic body type, short and muscular, followed, reaching its apotheosis with the emergence of Simone Biles, the 4'9" powerhouse who might be the most technically advanced gymnast in history. Raisman was an exemplar of the new gymnast. From the age of 10, she practiced at least 3 hours a day, 6 days a week. Dive, flip, stick. And every 4 to 6 weeks, she and 20 potential Olympians traveled to an obscure location in a Texas pine forest for a 5-day practice session at the ranch, the legendary remote gymnasium complex owned by coaches Bela and Martha Caroli. The Carolis have dominated U.S. gymnastics for almost 40 years. They began their careers in the 1960s in Romania, their home country. They had a recipe for success. Pluck girls out of their homes, install them near a gym, and control their lives. In 1981, the Carolis defected to the U.S., which until then had had a bleak history in the sport, having won only one Olympic gymnastics medal, team bronze, in 1948. As they rose through the ranks of the National Federation, Bela and Martha became known as the U.S.'s top coaches, and in 2000, they established a semi-centralized Romanian-type system in the U.S. with some modifications. A prodigy like Raisman or Biles could stay in her hometown as long as she attended monthly 5-day practice sessions at the ranch. And there, Martha was absolute ruler, especially after USAG announced that the organization would no longer pick the Olympic team merely on the basis of scores at important competitions. Instead, seeking a more accurate indicator of the athlete's consistency, they would choose the team members by those scores plus their performance in practice sessions at the ranch. As a result, gymnasts and their coaches began to hide injuries while there, often compounding the girl's problems. Nor were gymnasts offered a chance to rest and restore after their hours of daily practice. At the ranch, Raisman says they slept on uncomfortable bunk beds in primitive rooms with bugs underfoot and showers that sometimes lacked hot water. The Caroli Ranch did not employ a nutritionist or possess rehabilitation equipment beyond an ice bath. Raisman also explains that gymnasts were served nutritionless food, such as powdered eggs and instant coffee. Because they dined at the same time as their coaches, they also felt pressure to undereat. They certainly did not want to be seen pigging out in front of coaches. The Carolis did not respond to questions. At night, while the coaches sometimes gathered at the Carolis' home to play canasta, Nasser treated girls in their rooms, even though he didn't have a license to practice medicine in Texas. He brought the gymnast candy, a tactic that worked particularly well because the girls were very hungry. Nasser told the girls that they could talk to him honestly about their injuries. He positioned himself as the one adult at the ranch whom they could trust, a moral authority who would shield them from other uncaring adults. And it is important to note, Nasser was the only doctor whom USAG allowed top gymnast to see. Parents were not invited to the ranch, and cell phone service was so poor that the girls rarely called home. Nor were parents allowed to stay in the same hotels as their children during their busy travel schedule of elite meets. One mom told me parents were also instructed not to create a distraction before competitions by hugging their children or wishing them good luck. From time to time, gymnasts whispered to each other about Nasser. They'd call him Crotch Doc or Butt Doc. Wasn't he weird? Was what he did to them on the massage table all right? On the Olympic team, the whispers began in 2011 when Michaela Maroney, who would go on to win a silver medal in the vault at the 2012 Games, broke down after a particularly brutal massage session. The other girls talked with her about what had happened, but they didn't know what to do. They didn't trust the adults at the ranch enough to tell them a secret. Maybe they would get kicked off the team for being complainers. In 2015, Raisman, by this point a 20-year-old Olympic gold medalist, was in the ranch's gym with Maggie Nichols, a young gymnast from Minnesota who was Biles' best friend. They were talking about Nasser when Nichols' coach, Sarah Jancy, overheard their chatter. The coach sat Nichols down for a talk. Then she phoned Nichols' mother, Gina, to tell her what she'd learned. "I almost died," Gina Nichols told me, about hearing that Nasser could have been molesting her child. Jancy reported Nasser's abuse to Rhonda Fain, a former elite gymnast turned USAG executive who gave the information to Steve Penny, the organization's president. Penny, the father of triplet adolescent girls, is a canny sports marketer who turned American cycling into a powerhouse in the 1990s and received kudos for similar success with gymnastics after he landed at USAG in 1999. Penny and Gina spoke, but Penny did not call the police, as might be expected with an accusation of sexual abuse of a minor. His attorney, Edith Mathai, says that Penny didn't call because he did not think there was sufficient information at that point to believe that molestation occurred. Instead, Penny hired an Indianapolis-based human resources investigator to interview Nichols and Raisman. 5 weeks later, when the report was complete, Penny reported the abuse to the FBI's Indianapolis office. He also forced Nasser out. When Nasser announced his departure on Facebook, as a voluntary resignation in advance of plans to run for his local school board, Penny did not publicly object. Nor did Penny call Michigan State to inform officials there of what he knew. He says that the FBI, concerned about compromising its investigation, asked him not to speak to others about Nassar. Nassar continued his medical practice at the college and a Michigan gymnastics gym called Twistars for nearly a year, until the story of his abuse finally leaked to the Indianapolis Star, which launched an investigation. 40 Michigan athletes have come forward to say that Nassar abused them in the year between Gina's initial complaint to Penny and Nassar's arrest. When Maggie was overheard at the ranch, she was ranked second in the country behind Biles. But 4 months after the Olympics, she tore her meniscus while training for her Aminar, a vault that incorporates 2.5 twist. Raisman told me Maggie came back strong before the Olympic trials and was still thought by many to be a contender for the team. But when Maggie's parents showed up at the Olympic trials in San Jose, California, the NBC production team, which normally reserved seats for relatives and friends of the gymnast in order for their cameramen to get good audience shots, had failed to get seats for them, according to Gina. All the other girls' parents' seats were numbered off, and even before the trials started, ours weren't included, Gina said. Next photos, 2012 Olympic gold medal winners Michaela Maroney, Weiber, Gabrielle Douglas, Raisman, and Kyla Ross. Bela and Martha Caroli at Caroli Ranch in Huntsville, Texas, 2011. Gymnast training at the ranch, 2011. Martha Caroli, supervising stretches at the ranch, 2008. Maggie was off the Olympic team. Martha said Maggie's scores and specialty disqualified her for the team. But Gina believes Penny may have intervened. He was afraid about us saying something about the abuse. I truly believe that, when I look back, Gina told me. Penny denies this. She says that Penny called her multiple times that year. And when Biles asked Maggie to visit her at home in Texas to film a Hershey's commercial, Gina and Maggie traveled to the state for the day. When they returned, Gina received a call from Penny, who was angry that Maggie had filmed the commercial without his consent. He was screaming and swearing at me on the phone, Gina told me, quietly sobbing. I knew right then, if that's the way he was talking to me, that he wasn't even considering her for the Olympics. Penny's attorney denies Gina's characterization of these events and says that Penny was simply trying to make sure Maggie did not violate NCAA rules about filming commercials. I asked Jennifer Say, a former national champion and the author of Chalked Up, a 2008 book about her childhood in gymnastics, whether she believed Maggie had been unfairly sidelined. He, Penny, ran USAG like a third-world dictatorship, Say said. The girls were just inventory. If you did anything you weren't supposed to do or say, you would be ostracized, swept aside, and another girl was chosen. That's what happened to Maggie, sadly. Penny's attorney disputes this. At no time did Mr. Penny ever say a negative word about Maggie, and in fact made sure that she was among the athletes considered by the selection committee. More generally, she rejected the notion that Penny treated the girls as inventory. All of the athletes mattered to Steve, she says. Maggie retired from elite competition shortly after those Olympic trials, and is now a sophomore at the University of Oklahoma studying sports broadcasting. For the past 2 years, she has been a number one ranked gymnast in the NCAA. When I spoke to her recently, she had just returned from a sports massage, a real one. She doesn't like conducting interviews about Nasser and rarely talks to journalists. Thinking about him, she said, makes me very upset and sad and puts me in a bad mood. When I think about it or talk about it, I kind of just want to be by myself and close myself from everything. She did not travel to Aquilina's courtroom in Lansing to deliver a victim impact statement. She told me she had too much to do at school. Maggie still loves gymnastics. She was eager to tell me about the life lessons she had learned from the sport. It's helped me with time management and to be very independent, because in gymnastics you're traveling all the time, she said, choosing her words carefully. It's taught me to be confident. You have to go out there and do your best routine under the highest amount of pressure. I feel like I grew up at a very young age with gymnastics. She said she was trying to look at life in a positive light these days. She wanted to enjoy gymnastics, and she believed that enjoying herself is making her better at her sport, too. When Maggie decided to retire, she wrote an essay for her fans that told how, as a little girl, she would go to the mall with her mom and stand at a wishing well. Each time she threw a penny in the water, she wished that someday she would make it to the Olympics. The stars didn't align for her, though, and that was all right. She had tried as hard as she could. She had done her best. I think I made that little girl proud, that little Maggie proud, she wrote. Not to be overly dramatic, but what is the price of little girls' dreams? Nichols, Raisman, and the rest gave themselves over to our national gymnastics system, body, mind, and soul. They didn't do it for the money. And, in fact, the only way to make significant money in gymnastics is through sponsorships around making the Olympic team. When told to obey, they obeyed. The gymnast had no institutional voice in the sport at all, said Say. It's almost like they were gaslit. Think of this. You're a kid with your ankle broken. They, some coaches say, you're lazy. Get back out there. You're hungry. They tell you, you're fat. It's so disorienting that you don't trust your perception of the world anymore. In the past few months, USAG has implemented some changes. It has closed the ranch. It is also working with Safe Sport, a new Denver-based center that will process any future abuse claims on Olympic teams. Most important, they have expanded the list of banned coaching behaviors to include not only sexual abuse, but also verbal and emotional abuse. It now not only permits parents or another chaperone to travel to camps and competitions with their daughters, it requires it. Some gymnastic meets are streamed online, and when I watched this year's American Cup in Chicago on YouTube with my 6-year-old daughter, we recoiled in horror as Mao Yi, a Chinese gymnast and Olympic bronze medalist, crumpled to the ground as she dismounted the vault. After falling, she propped herself up on a forearm and put one hand to her forehead in a gesture of agonized disappointment. Then the screen abruptly switched to the USAG logo. No one needed to see a gymnast wheeled away. My daughter sat on my lap, staring at the screen. They're trying to fix her, so they're waiting a little, she said. Then she added, I feel sad for that girl. They will give her a rest, and then her next turn will come up. Would I sign up my daughter for gymnastics today, knowing what I know? I would have answered no on the day that we watched Mao Yi collapse. The heartbreak isn't worth it. The potential for harm, both physical and psychological, isn't worth it. Mao was 18 and had just broken her left femur. Her chance of another turn at the Olympics is slender. But when I spoke with a dozen gymnasts about the future of the sport, I was heartened by their deep engagement in solving its problems. Molly Shawn, a national champion in the 1990s and currently a coach of kid gymnasts in Louisville, Kentucky, told me that the community has talked about coordinating to try to disband USAG and begin a new national organization from scratch. Raisman put it this way to me, all those people who knew and didn't do anything, they need to be gone. Burning down the house is tempting, but at the moment it seems that the leadership of USAG will survive, and foot soldiers across the country, like Shawn, are committed to making gymnast as good as it can possibly be. First, among Shawn's recommendations is a rigorous system for approving coaches. Right now, anyone can become a gymnastics coach after passing a basic background check, a safety certification, and an online course. In some sports, such lax regulation might not matter so much, but not in gymnastics. If you don't shoot the basketball through the hoop, you don't get 3 points, Shawn says. In gymnastics, the difference between missing your hand on a vault or release move means you break your neck, she pointed out. This is a psychological sport, and there are a lot of issues with fear. Shawn also pointed out USAG's historic refusal to provide what she called aftercare for gymnasts. When I retired from gymnastics, I never heard a word from them ever again, she said. They dump you off the back of the truck and leave you in a lost world. USAG declined to comment on the subject of aftercare in the past. Shawn had a scholarship to Stanford University when she tore her ulnar ligament, and after surgery, she could not stop taking hydrocodone. When you go from being one of the best female athletes in the world to a freaking train wreck of a mess who can't get out of bed, it should send off warning signs to the people around you. But I was perceived as weak and a quitter, and I struggled with that so much for so many years, she told me. She never thought she'd find herself back in a gym. But one day in Cincinnati, she entered the gym where she had first become a star. She breathed in the smell of nasty feet, and I was home. Today, she's preparing to take the test to become an international brevet, one of the highest levels of judging in the sport. Simone Biles' respected former coach, Amy Borman, who is being whispered about as the possible new national coach replacing Martha Carolee, spoke to me about the need for more education for coaches. Positive coaching involves using your resources to help increase an athlete's skill, while nurturing them to understand that success comes from within, she declared. If a gymnast is struggling with a skill, some coaches will kick them out of practice. My question to that would be, how is that constructive? She says that USAG is moving in the right direction, but she believes coaches should be required to take technical classes, as Shawn recommends, and to take classes on mental health and nutrition. Requiring these qualifications would eliminate those people who are not qualified while increasing the knowledge of those that are, she says. What else needs to change? When I ask Raisman this question, her words come out in a torrent. We are in the dark hotel bar where we began our conversation. Amid clandestine lovebirds drinking martinis, both of us are having cups of tea. In the lobby, the hotel's designer, doubtlessly striving for timeless elegance, had installed Grecian statues of discus throwers and white colonnades that do not seem to support any particular structure. And yet, the sole Olympian in the room is across from me. I should not be surprised that she is taking her post-Olympics activism as seriously as she did her gymnastics. She projects self-assurance, though I detect a coexisting hum of anxiety, as though she is about to be pursued by a large animal. In this way, she is like so many successful athletes, confident of her audacious talents, but always sweating her next big competition. Making her recommendations for the future of her sport, she's so excited that she starts leaning forward in her seat. We need to have a fantastic female doctor, a couple of them at that, great female athletic trainers, massage therapist, female ones, a sports dietitian, a really good one, to educate the coaches and also the athletes. Get a psychiatrist that's completely separate from USA Gymnastics, and we'll keep what the athletes say confidential. For the new ranch, she wants proper bedding. In your room, you should have a bathtub, no bunk beds, real food, a smoothie bar, vegan options, options for girls with allergies. A time when you can be on your own, she says. There needs to be a little trust so that the athletes can take a day off and go shopping or watch a movie. Raisman is also asking adults who coach kids to complete an online course with Darkness to Light, a nonprofit dedicated to fighting sexual abuse. For example, Nasser used to take hundreds of photos of top gymnasts. That's a sign of someone who may be too interested in kids and should raise a red flag. Every adult is responsible, and there's no excuse of it's none of my business or I wasn't sure, she says. If one adult had had the character to act, Nasser would have been stopped. Raisman personally signs each certificate. She also wants to readjust society's trust in perfect male healers. When I was younger, the doctor told me only a doctor is allowed to touch your private parts. We have to change that. Raisman has also been impressively unafraid of provocation and of exhibiting her own mature sexuality. American culture may have long regarded the phrase sexy gymnast as taboo. Gymnasts are supposed to remain eternally sexless, eternally girls, but she is changing this sad old game. This winter, she posed for Sports Illustrated without clothes. Black capital letters ran down her torso and onto one toned leg, forming the sentence, "Women do not have to be modest to be respected." Simone Biles is focused on 2020, but supportive of the public activism Raisman, Nichols, and Weiber have been engaged in. Because of the commitment to change of all these women, there's reason to be optimistic. In Los Angeles, I met with Jordan Weiber, one of Raisman's Olympic teammates. She grew up in Lansing and began gymnastics as a four-year-old after a scout identified her as a freakish-looking kid with weird muscles. Her mother gave her a solemn pledge that when Jordan began the sport, she would never miss any of her meets. And aside from one that conflicted with her godmother obligations, she never did. Nasser knew Weiber when she was a toddler and began abusing her when she was 14. When Weiber took the lectern in Aquilina's courtroom, Nasser began to weep. Weiber is now a gymnastics coach at UCLA. We met in the university gym, which has a large window overlooking the area where the college team practices. But since they had left for the day to attend classes, the local kids program had taken over. We peered down to watch girls as young as my daughter somersaulting and unsteadily balancing on beams. Weiber told me she had been motivated by fear throughout her career. We just developed a weird relationship to authority where we listened to whatever they said. She has sworn she won't treat anyone the way she was treated. She tries to understand each girl and what she needs in the moment. If what she needs is rest, the girl gets it. Her team also talks openly about sexual and emotional abuse. From what I've heard, a lot of college programs aren't even talking about Nassar. And at UCLA, we have decided that we need to talk about it, Weiber says. When I ask her what she'd say to a mom who, post-Nassar, won't sign her daughter up for gymnastics, she said, "I think the sport is so amazing. I think it's so amazing that I'm coaching it, and hopefully when kids are a little older, it will be a safer sport, too." A few days after I talked to Weiber, I attended a UCLA meet against Oregon State. Several subjects of this story told me I needed to watch a collegiate competition because they were so much more fun than elite meets. And this one didn't disappoint. The stands were crammed with moms and preteen daughters in Bruin blue, even some with blue-painted fingernails. I sat next to a gym mom who ran a janitorial company. She told me about her sacrifices to pay for her daughter's gymnastics training and the bingo night she ran at a local restaurant to raise money. "Except for the girls who go to the Olympics and can get sponsors and all that, this isn't a money-making sport," she said. "You do it because you love it." On the floor, Weiber and her senior coach paced in slingback heels. Every time a girl finished a routine, her teammates, who wore teal ribbons in their hair to support sexual abuse survivors, screamed and cheered. As Beyoncé's Run the World girls pumped over the loudspeakers, UCLA pulled ahead on the uneven bars and vault. Next were acrobatic dance routines on the floor. Caitlin Ohashi, a two-time All-American who had been a favorite for the last Olympics but got derailed by shoulder surgery, stood on a corner of the mat. Once in the grips of a vicious eating disorder, she now looked healthy, happy, and ready to throw down a routine to a medley of Michael Jackson songs. Ohashi dashed across the mat, performing back splits, mid-air splits, mid-air somersaults, and even a little moonwalking. From the sidelines, Weiber watched intently, her hands by her sides, and each time Ohashi stuck a landing, Weiber clenched her fist. They were having fun, and when Ohashi finished, the judges awarded her a perfect 10.
Thank you.
Grandpop. The pioneer of West Coast Cool is on a roll. As he mounts four exhibitions, Ed Ruscha invites Mark Rozzo to his L.A. studio to explain how his genius comes to life. Photographs by Mark Mahaney. Opening photos, Ed Ruscha in Culver City, California. And with his drumhead artwork, he up and went downtown. One afternoon last spring, I rode shotgun with the artist Ed Ruscha as he guided his silver-gray Tesla along the streets of Culver City, California, where he works out of a 9,000-square-foot former prop warehouse. The overcast sky was gauzy, like one of his gunpowder drawings from the 1960s. As a driver, Ruscha is calm, collected, and, it's unavoidable, cool. With electric blue eyes scanning the road and big-knuckled hands on the wheel, he radiated imperturbability. A breeze riffled his silver hair. When he ran over a recently reconfigured curb, it hardly fazed him. It might be a good idea to tackle this issue at the start. How cool is Ed Ruscha anyway? Cool, after all, is the adjective that has attached itself most tenaciously to the artist and his work, which, over a 60-year arc, has encompassed painting, drawing, bookmaking, photography, a multitude of printing techniques, even a couple of short movies, one of which, Premium, from 1971, showed the fashion model Leon Bing in a bed covered with a giant salad. Ruscha, to quote the business card he once passed around, which has marked on it pronounced Ruscha, has been a pop art wunderkind thanks to his eye-grabbing early 60s word paintings such as Oof and Boss, along with his iconic depictions of filling stations and the Hollywood sign. He has been a wily conceptualist as well, known for his poker-faced photo books, like 26 gasoline stations and 34 parking lots in Los Angeles. He is a godfather of both of those art movements, arguably the two most important in the last half century, which is no small thing. He may be the only artist who can claim that. Ruscha has also been considered a minimalist, a surrealist, and a neo-Dadaist, sometimes all at once. You could hang any one of three or four labels on him, said Irving Bloom, the director of L.A.'s legendary Ferris Gallery, which brought Ruscha to prominence in the early 1960s, alongside such artists as Robert Irwin, Ed Moses, Billy Al Bingston, and Ed Kainholz. But he's very much his own man. Ruscha is the unofficial artist laureate of Los Angeles, a municipality whose official currency happens to be coolness. There's even a mural of him downtown. It's got the right kind of decadence and lack of charm it takes to make an artist, he once said of the city that did, in fact, make him one. In 1956, at age 18, he rolled into L.A. in a customized 1950 Ford from his hometown of Oklahoma City, along with his good pal Mason Williams, who would eventually make a splash as a comedy writer for the Smothers Brothers, and as the hitmaker behind the devilishly catchy instrumental Classical Gas. The journey was part on the road and part Grapes of Wrath. There was no mattress tied to the roof, but the teenage Okies pointed themselves directly at California's Eden. The 1,300-mile road trip looms large in the cosmology of Ruscha and by extension of modern American art. He is to highways, service stations, and signage what Warhol was to soup cans. When I asked Ruscha about the high points of the trip, he laughed and said Santa Rosa, New Mexico. What do they call that, the fan belt capital of the world? I think we spent more money on gasoline than we did on food. The response was vintage Ruscha, upfront and yet utterly enigmatic. also cool. Surveying it all, the late novelist J.G. Ballard observed that Rouchet has the coolest gaze in American art. When I ask Larry Gagosian, Rouchet's dealer, what he admires about Rouchet's work, he said, the coolness of it. The title of a video that accompanied the 2016 Rouchet show at San Francisco's De Young Museum was, Who is Ed Rouchet and why is he so damn cool? Actor Stephen Dorff once described Rouchet to me as the epitome of cool. Michael Naismith, the musician, music video pioneer, and actor best known for his role on The Monkees, once told me Rouchet was the coolest guy he'd ever met. Leon Bing called him the king of shit-kicker cool. Rouchet turned 80 last December. He and the concept of cool came of age at the same time. Yet Rouchet and his work have always been more than just cool. You wonder if the label has become counterproductive. It's a most overused word, Rouchet said in his Heartland drawl. There's something good and rich about it, but everybody uses it today, even insurance salesmen. His father, Edward Joseph Rouchet III, was, incidentally, an auditor with the Hartford Insurance Company. Rouchet said he did nothing to celebrate becoming an octogenarian, aside from a quiet dinner. But 2018 has been a celebratory year, punctuated by four major museum exhibitions. In February, the Joslin Art Museum in Omaha, where Rouchet was born in 1937 and lived before his family moved to Oklahoma in 1941, mounted a sweeping retrospective. In May, Denmark's Louisiana Museum of Modern Art opened a show. The Secession in Vienna will open another in November, and this month, the National Gallery, London, hosts Ed Rouchet, Course of Empire, a cycle of 10 enormous industrial landscapes that encompass two connected series done about a dozen years apart. Rouchet first premiered them at the 2005 Venice Biennale, but now they will hang concurrently with an exhibition, recently decamped from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, devoted to the 19th-century British-American landscape artist Thomas Cole, whose own Course of Empire paintings inspired Rouchet's. It feels like a pantheonic moment. Over the past decade or so, the pop art pioneer has become a global pop culture hero. In 2009, the Obamas pulled a Rouchet from the federal collection and hung it in the White House. In 2014, at Christie's in New York, Rouchet's 1963 smash, that word, italicized and all caps, yellow, on dark blue, was hammered down at $30.4 million. Today, Rouchet's work is chased by a new wave of collectors from Japan and Qatar. He's somehow become more resonant and more relevant over time, Gagosian told me. Bloom agreed that Rouchet's status, rising along with the status of L.A. as a global art capital, is now in an unassailable place. Christopher Riopel, a curator at the National Gallery who helped to organize the Rouchet and Cole shows, positioned Rouchet as a singular colossus. At this point, he said, he is arguably the most important American artist. Next photos, Rouchet's Pay Nothing Until April, 2003. Rouchet and his wife Dana, 1971. Our Flag by Rouchet, 2017. By now, a lot of people have collected my work, Rouchet acknowledged back at his studio. Even so, he didn't seem ready to put on the weighty mantle of the grandee. It's still almost a new thing for me. I mean, every day it seems to be a little newer. Rouchet keeps it new by remaining as active as he's ever been. He has no plans to retire the way, say, Philip Roth, another master who has shown Americans who they are, hung it up when he turned 80. Ruscha clocks in at the studio daily, quite early, sometimes staying late, often coming in over the weekend. "I'm kind of insulated in this place here," he said, "but that's not a complaint." I ask him if those days have a predictable shape, if there is a standard Ruscha operating procedure. "Well, sometimes I'm fumbling," he said, "and sometimes I have a vague idea." Ruscha's work tends to be declarative in an off-kilter way, and his statements about it have the same quality. His mother once called him a master of evasion. In describing his recent Psycho Spaghetti Westerns series, he has said the paintings show tangled-up messes like spaghetti, and we're living out here in the West, and we're all psycho. He has called his oeuvre a gumbo of gravel, which naturally sounds like a Ruscha painting itself. What he aims for in the art he creates, he said in 1973, is to produce a kind of, huh? It is perhaps the best-known Ruscha-ism, and it's not evasive at all. It's marksman-like in its accuracy. His studio is low-slung, gray, anonymous, an exemplar of the banal vernacular L.A. that Ruscha has captured in so many paintings and photographs. A gold 1949 Oldsmobile Rocket 88 sits out front. It lets you know you found the right place. Out back is Ruscha's 1933 Ford pickup, along with a 1939 Ford sedan he bought in 1959 for $40. The car made a cameo in a 1962 lithograph called 3327 Division. The vintage automobiles feel emblematic. Ruscha moved here in 2011 after 26 years in a former Coors warehouse on Electric Avenue in Venice, and before that at his long-running studio on Western Avenue. The operation still has an office in Venice, overseen by studio director Mary Dean, a gregarious Michigander who's worked with the artist since 1998 and claims to have never heard him raise his voice in anger. Ruscha's deadpan humor, even-keeled temperament, and brought upright manners, not to mention Hollywood-ready good looks, tend to have a fairy dust effect on others. Like his pal Artie Shaw, the gallivanting jazz clarinetist and bandleader, he has had several high-profile relationships over the years, with partners such as Bing, Lauren Hutton, Samantha Egger, and Eve Babbitts. The man charms the world. The critic Dave Hickey once noted that the artist is so nice to everybody. Frank Geary, the architect, has been a friend of Ruscha's for more than 50 years. "He's not a prima donna," he told me. "I never hear him bad-mouthing anybody." The studio rambles, but it's no factory. There is no swarm of assistants daubing giant canvases. A shy rescue dog named Lola patrols the place, trailing Ruscha from work zone to work zone. The nearby garden lends a homey touch. It's a mini plantation of citrus trees, wild strawberries, tomatoes, sunflowers, and jalapenos, along with fledgling Joshua trees growing in pots from seeds the artist collects from his property in the Mojave Desert. Geary provided some design input for the house. Next, photos. Mother's Boys, a variation of our flag. A model of an upcoming exhibition. In Ruscha's studio. Wooden frames awaiting canvases. Ruscha's wife, Dana, is an effervescent former animation artist. She told me she never sets foot in the studio. The Ruscha's married in 1967 when Dana was 23, broke up in 1972, and remarried in 1988 at the same Las Vegas chapel they used the first time around. They live in the Truesdell Estates section of Beverly Hills in a house formerly owned by Hollywood super agent Swifty Lazar. The studio, nonetheless, is a family affair. Their son, Edward Joseph Ruscha V, known as Eddie, a 49-year-old artist and musician whose albums are included in the studio's vinyl collection, alongside Captain Beefheart, a Ruscha favorite, pitches in. Ruscha has a 30-year-old daughter, Sonny Ruscha Granade, from another relationship. She recently gave birth to Ruscha's third grandchild. The artist's younger brother, Paul Ruscha, a photographer, artist, and writer, has been a key part of the studio's workings since 1973. He calls his brother a great boss and helps him photograph Los Angeles thoroughfares, a long-running project that grew out of Ruscha's landmark 1966 book, Every Building on the Sunset Strip, which is exactly what it sounds like. The brothers have returned to Sunset Boulevard every few years with a motorized Nikon mounted on a truck, capturing the very evolution of the city. They've also shot Sepulveda, La Cienega, and Hollywood Boulevards, among others. When I was with Ruscha, he thought of a downtown L.A. byway he'd never shot before, Cosmo Street. I gotta write that down. The urge toward all-encompassing documentation goes way back. Growing up in Oklahoma City, Ruscha imagined creating a diorama of his entire daily Oklahoman paper route, a notion equal parts Leave It to Beaver and Jorge Luis Borges. I kept dreaming about doing it and never got around to it, he admits. The artist-to-be would hoard quotidian objects in carefully labeled matchboxes. Money I have found. Teeth I have lost. My mother just broke up in tears of laughter, Ruscha told me of these exploits. Her name was Dorothy née Driscoll, a notorious cut-up, Irish and German, in contrast to his father, a serious Catholic of German-Bohemian background. The family name is said to derive from Ruschitska. Next photos, a 1933 Ford Model B pickup at the studio. Ruscha examines time and again. Recent acrylic on vellum works. A copy of Hurry Up Schedule. The Higgins brand of India ink was the young Ruscha's artistic rosebud. You could spill it out on a piece of paper and watch it dry, he said. It would harden and crack apart into this shiny surface. Ruscha was captivated. He began using the ink to emulate the comic strips he saw in the papers he delivered, particularly Dick Tracy. Dave Hickey has called Ruscha a child of pop from the cities of the plain, and it's a useful shorthand. Young Ed loved not only the funny pages, but also Hollywood movies and the R&B he heard on late-night radio. Gospel to us, he said. I look back on the years that I grew up, the artist told me, and I see it through a black-and-white lens, you know. I see it as though it's an old movie. He paused to deploy a phrase he likes. It's from Ago. When Ruscha got to L.A., he enrolled at the Schoenaar Art Institute, now Cal Arts, aiming toward commercial art. Seeing Jasper John's Target with Four Faces in a magazine, he has said, was an atomic bomb in my training. At Schoenaar, abstract expressionism held sway. But now Ruscha realized he could work in a way that was premeditated, that is, proceeding from a plan and painting actual things found in everyday life, proto-pop. He tacked decisively toward fine art, supplementing the rent with a gig hand-painting names on novelty denture containers. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.